Tiger Roll joins the greats.
Gordo Starr has done it. He's won 5 King Georges.
And welcome to the Lockdown Lowdown with me, Caroline Barker. Like all great crossovers, think Jack Bauer in The Simpsons, think maybe Carlos Tevez and Mascherano to West Ham. This is going to be just like those. Kevin Blake, he of the crossover fantasy dream that I've had many a time, is here with me to talk all things racing. We're going to go through the lingo, what we need to know, what we don't need to know, and generally get your expertise. No pressure, Kevin, can you handle it?
Absolutely, not a butter. It's been great to be with you, Caroline. I'm looking forward to this.
That's the right answer. Well done. You can come again. And let's start on where we are then, because it is lockdown, lowdown. But it seems like racing is being let free a little. What's happening?
It looks like we're on the right path, Caroline. We haven't seen any racing in the UK or Ireland since mid-March. But as the restrictions are easing, it looks like racing will certainly be back underway in the UK ASAP, and it will be one of the first sports to do so. And there's a few reasons why, but in a nutshell, you know, racing lends itself really well to the social distancing that's required in these unique circumstances. Protocols can be set up so that people aren't closely interacting with each other, either during in the build up to the event, in all the preparations that need to take place. And the closest anyone will get to each other is within a race, which is clearly in an outdoor setting at speeds of up to 40 miles an hour. In a nutshell, it's much better set up than most sports to go ahead, while other sports are unfortunately left in the starting blocks.
40 miles an hour is a bit faster than I do on my bike, so it should be all right. When we look at the equation, and they've talked a lot about this in football, say 200 to 300 people you'd need to get a Premier League game on. So is it a much smaller number that you'd need for racing?
Yeah, they reckon, I know certainly in Ireland, they reckon they can run a race meeting with somewhere between 100 and 150 people present on site. You know, as soon as anyone's business is finished, they will be asked to leave. And there's any amount of protocols and processes that will be put in place to make sure that the risk is as absolutely tiny as it possibly can be.
All right, that's where we are. All the very latest then on the Betfair website. Now, where do we want to be is the real question. If I am a novice, I mean, clearly, look at me, I'm made to be a jockey. But if I were a novice approaching horse racing for the first time, are we going into the flat, the jumps? Where are we in the season?
Well, right now it should be the height of the flat season. If we're in a normal year and the first classics would have taken place the weekend before last, at the beginning of May, but we're not there at the moment. But I think with a mid-May resumption, we'll be able to kick back into things quite quickly. And hopefully before we know it, we'll be back into the full swing of things, which is the height of the flat season. The jump season will have just finished there at the end of April. And while jump racing does continue through the summer, it doesn't really kick off again until October, November. So May, June, July, August, that's all about flat racing, the very best flat racing in the world.
And what sort of horses are we talking about then for the flat? What's the age of the horse? Who are the best performers?
So on the flat, horses will start off quite a bit earlier than they do over jumps. They will start racing some of them before they even turn two. And they'll all be two-year-olds technically, because that's one of the first little quirks we have in horse racing is we have a universal birthday. Every horse technically has their birthday on January 1st, regardless.
Why?
I'll tell you, it's a slightly boring story. It dates back to the mid-1800s that they made that decision. And it was basically for convenience in terms of not having horses changing ages in the middle of the season. And it causes quite a bit of problems from the breeding side of things. Because if the universal birthday is January 1st, from a breeding point of view, one wants to produce their horse as soon after January 1st as they can. Because the closer you're born to January 1st, the more of an advantage you have. If you're born on January 1st, we'll say, and the horse you're running against is born on May 15th, you know, you're 5.5 months older and you're racing in the same age group as that horse. So that's one slight thing to consider. And when two-year-old racing begins, it's something that a lot of punters will pay attention to. They will look at the birth date of the horses, because it goes without saying, if you're 5 months ahead of your opposition, that's a fair bit of an advantage when you're dealing with horses that are only 2 years of age. So that's the first thing. And we will see that as soon as racing kicks off again, we will see two-year-old racing. And that can be a little bit hard for people to get their heads around, because it is young. Typically, a thoroughbred racehorse won't reach full physical maturity until they're 5 years old. So these are babies. They are very much, they're still growing. But if you wanted to make a comparison, I'd say it would be something like under 16s, football or rugby. Right. Or whatever it is, these are still developing athletes, but they're still very, very capable. And in terms of the level of performance a two-year-old is capable of, it's not that far behind what a fully mature horse is capable of. And we do, on rare occasions, a little bit later on in the season, get to see two-year-olds taking on their much, much older rivals. And to allow that to happen... We're going down all sorts of bunny holes here,
Karen. Oh, I'm loving it. Don't worry. I'm far too interested in this bit. Go on.
what allows that to happen is we have a thing in racing called the weight for age scale. And that means that the younger the horse, they will receive weight, literally physical weight, off older rivals to compensate for that difference in age. And this scale was put in place by a guy called Admiral Rouse back in the 1800s. And what he actually put together, it was the most remarkable piece of work, because it has actually changed very, very little. It proved to be incredibly accurate, given it was the bones of 200 years ago. And look what I prepared earlier. I actually have a copy of it in front of me to give you a rough idea of what we're talking about here.
So someone's spending their time in lockdown wisely.
Oh, I'll tell you what. So... The first time we would generally see two-year-olds run against older rivals comes in about August. There's a Group 1 race at York called the Nuntar, and that would be the place we tend to see it. It's not all that common, but it does happen. And in that scenario, a two-year-old, which, like we say, are the real babies of horse racing, they would be receiving 26 pounds, which is just less than 2 stone, from older rivals. That is how much weight is deemed necessary to equalize their chance against their older opposition. So while they might be the equivalent of under 16s for humans, it only takes 2 stone in weight, quite literally lead in the saddle, to in theory, equalize them. So that's what we're dealing with. So while it might seem a bit odd to allow a teenager essentially to run against fully grown athletes, they're so precocious and so developed at that young age that they only need that relatively small amount of weight to equalize them.
So it's not like us as teenagers when we're all arms and everything all over the place. That how do you know, or do you know, is there kind of insider knowledge on how close to that January the 1st you're born? And then we'll move on, I promise. I am too interested in
No, that's fine, though, because I tell you what, I breed thoroughbreds myself. I've been doing it since I was a teenager. So this is very much in my wheelhouse. And there's basically a whole art to this. A thoroughbred, the gestation period is 11 months. Okay, so the breeding season for thoroughbreds, as a general rule of thumb, opens up on Valentine's Day, appropriately enough. So if your mare isn't in foal, if she isn't pregnant, you will be doing your best to get them ready to be covered in season, as the term goes, to be covered in mid-February. So they will give birth in mid-January, as close as they can to that January 1st date. But you don't want to get too chancy, because if you're born on December 31st, you will technically be 1 year of age when you get to January 1st. And that has happened. That is a good old-fashioned disaster.
And that
does happen very, very occasionally. That's doing your job a little bit too well and finding yourself in a bit of a pickle. But most of the time, we're trying. And again, we're probably going a small bit deeper than you intended. But it's not all about getting it right and getting close to January. Because I know myself, when a mare gives birth in January, what's the situation like in January? It's cold. There's no grass. The foals that are born in January don't actually thrive as quickly as a foal that's born in mid-March or April, when the weather is warmer, there's more green, protein-filled grass out in the paddocks, foals that are born middle of the breeding season, they will start to thrive a bit faster. So while it might seem on the surface that being 3 months older is a big advantage, it isn't quite so simple. There is a small bit of nuance to it as well.
Welcome to National Geographic with Kevin Blake and Caroline Barker. All right, let's go on to the races then. You mentioned the weights, and that kind of sounds a lot to me like in golf when you have a handicap. And we hear that word handicap, and when we dive into the lingo of racing, when you're on race day, we hear that a lot. Why?
The handicap system underpins all of horse racing. And basically, like you say, it's an excellent comparison. Golf. The purpose of the handicap system in golf is to try to equalize the chance of all the golfers and the performance of the golfers, just as it is with the horses. The performance of the horses is judged by the handicapper, and he will give a numerical assessment of that horse's ability, and that is their handicap mark. And the job that the handicapper is trying to do is to handicap every single horse so that they can be put into various different bands that try to get horses of similar ability all together in the same races. And the horses with the slightly higher marks, going back to weight again, will carry more weight proportionate to the difference in the handicap marks. So in theory, if the handicapper has done an excellent job in assessing those horses' abilities, they'll all finish in a straight line. But of course, that doesn't happen, because that is really the nuances of horse racing. You have to try to figure out that in a particular race, on a particular day, in a very specific set of circumstances, be it the race is run over, the track it's being run at, what the ground is like, so many, quite literally endless variables in horse racing. You're trying to use all those variables to figure out which horse will be best suited by them and will be able to run closest to their mark or even improve on what they've shown previously, which will allow them to win that handicap on the day. And the vast majority of races in the sport of horse racing in Britain and Ireland are handicaps. To expand on that a little bit, that is the bread and butter of horse racing. But when a horse is winning handicaps, their handicap mark rises, and it rises and it rises, and they get to a point where they're too good to run in handicaps. And it's clear that they're capable of running in what we call stakes races. And these are, if we want to build the scale, the lowest class of stakes race is called a listed race. Then we have a Group 3, Group 2, Group 1, which is the absolute pinnacle of the sport. That is what the very, very best horses run in, the Group 1 races. And that is the general scale. You have all the handicap races from rock bottom up to the very best handicaps, which you see at Royal Ascot, the Royal Hunt Cup, the Wokingham, very famous races like that. But beyond that, listed, Group 3, Group 2, Group 1.
Right. So I'm looking out for the age. I'm looking out for the optimum handicap. When it comes to race day, what else am I listening for? What should I be looking at? Those nuances?
Oh, there's any amount. Caroline, you know, you'll hear people talking about the form book, you know, the form book working out. And the form book is where all the keys to the answers to those questions lie. Because generally, when one is looking at a horse race, we have an amount of evidence in front of us. And that is what the horse has previously done. And that is the art of working out what's going to win a horse race. You look at what's happened previously. You're examining what circumstances have shown each horse the best effect. And try, you know, in its most simplest form, you might try to find horses that have done very well in the set of circumstances that look to be presenting to them again on the day you're looking at. But then if you want to take it a layer deeper, you can examine what the horse has done before, and using your judgment and your knowledge, you can take an opinion, right? This horse has never run on soft ground before. He's meeting soft ground today for the first time in his life. But I have quite an in-depth knowledge of this horse's pedigree. And his two half-brothers love soft ground. His mother loves soft ground. When I look at this horse physically galloping, his action, the way he moves his legs, his mechanics, suggest that he will thrive on soft ground. So while when one looks at the form book, this horse has never won on soft ground or never even raced on soft ground, I might take a view, I think that's really going to suit him. So I might go and have a bet on that horse. And you know, and you get to find out on the only proving ground that matters on the race course if you're right or not. But that's the sort of, you know, again, we're dealing with different dips. You know, one can rock up to a race course and have a bet because they like a horse's name, they like the colours. But if you want to dive deep, really try to dig, to find an edge, to find variables, you know, it really is a bottomless ocean of information and possibilities in horse racing. And that's what attracts a certain type of person to racing, to get really deeply involved. You know, I personally, I have a very numbers-based mind, and I love analyzing and statistics. And if you are into that sort of thing and you want to dive deep, you know, horse racing really, really suits that type of mind, because it is, like I say, bottomless. You'll never get to the bottom of it.
But is those things as a sports fan, isn't it? You love the emotion, but you love the geeky side of it too. Will there be something slightly different given that these races for the foreseeable are going to be behind closed doors? So we've got that, to use a racing term, but we've got that blinkered view, haven't we? How can you gauge how a horse is feeling? You know, that bit when you see them maybe a bit reticent to go into the stalls, when they don't want to get going, something you might, if you're down there by the track, be looking at its edgy and maybe it's not fancying it today. How can you get that when you're sat behind a screen?
Well, that's an art in itself. You know, we'd call the term that you'd often hear is paddock watching. And it's very, very specialist now. There wouldn't be loads of people that work in the racing media or that produce work publicly that would be very good at that. You know, it's very specialist. You know, the old cliche is, you know, you need to be born in a stable with a horse to really understand them. But there is an art to it. There is something to it. And, you know, I spend an awful lot of time working with horses here at home and just watching them, you know, and you get to know their personalities, you get to know their quirks. But I think in a racing context, what's most important to know about a horse's behavior is what's normal for them. You know, you'll hear general cliches. Oh, this horse is sweating. You know, he's foaming up between his legs. That's a big negative. Oh, he's very fractious. That must be a big negative. But the real key in terms of watching horses at a horse race is knowing what's normal for them. If, you know, it might seem a negative for a horse to be in a lather of sweat and getting very excited before a race. But if you know that horse and you've watched him in his last 10 runs and he's done the exact same thing every time, it's nothing to be concerned about. But if you've watched him for his last 10 runs and he's been quiet as a lamb and dry as a bone walking around the parade ring, and all of a sudden today he's really sweaty and looking very wound up, that is almost certainly a significant negative. You know, you need to know what's normal. And when you get a deviation from the normal, that's generally a bad thing.
Well, foaming and sweaty is generally a bad thing for anyone. If you're looking at that. but that lingo when it's happening, when you're hearing the commentator say that, because we'll all be consuming via TV, radio, however it might be, what are the words you should be honing in on then, and what should be those kind of red flags that you go, all right, not today, thank you?
Well, you'd like to hope, and it's not always the case, but you'd like to hope that the pundits on TV will be familiar with the horses, you know. And it's very valuable, you know, because if the camera switches onto your horse and, like you say, sweating, fractious, needing two handlers to try and keep the horse under wraps in the parade ring, that instinctively seems a negative. But if the pundit on TV can say, well, I saw this horse run last time when he won by 10 lengths and he did the exact same thing beforehand, so he's probably not helping himself in doing what he's doing, but he's been able to overcome that and perform in the past. So that's very relevant information if you can get it. And, you know, you spot other signs as well with horses, you know, a reluctance to load, you know, going into the stalls. You know, we haven't touched on that yet. All flat races, with a couple of minor exceptions, are started from starting stalls. You're at the time you're declared to run, there is a random draw to decide what stall you're coming out of. And that's what the races are started from, to ensure an even start. But again, once you dig a little bit deeper, think of a track like Chester. I don't know if you're familiar with Chester.
Went to a very nice wedding there, Kevin.
Well, the racetrack at Chester is, you might imagine, horses running around the inside of a saucer. It is very, very tight. They're always turning. And logically, anyone that's familiar with cycling or anything like that will tell you, if you're drawn wide at Chester and your horse is caught out three or four horses wide and you're constantly turning, they're quite literally covering a lot more ground than the horse that's tied up against the rail. So the draw at a track like Chester is absolutely vital. You might really, really fancy a horse that's running at Chester, but being drawn in stall number one against the rail or stall number 12 out in the car park is a massive difference that's likely to very much, it'll certainly change the odds, and it might well change your opinion on the race too. So
can I see that anywhere, Kevin? Is there a, you know, this horse does better when it's in two at this course? Can I see that anywhere, or is it not that scientific?
No, draw stats would be very, very popular. And at a place like Chester, where the draw is particularly significant, like if you were watching racing from Chester, there will be endless talk about the draw, because everyone is very, that'd be the most vivid example of this that you probably get in British racing. So everyone is honed in on that. But then to take it a little bit deeper again, at Royal Ascot, in a race like the Royal Hunt Cup or the Wokingham, these massive field handicaps, you know, the bones of 30 runners, and they're running in a straight line down the track. So one would think, oh, what does the draw matter? They're running in a straight line. But just to complicate things again, you get scenarios where certain parts of the track, the ground is firmer than other parts of the track. So thus, it's a more advantageous place to be, because as you can imagine, if me and you were having a race across the field and the part I was running on was boggy and the part you were running on was like tarmac, you're at a major advantage off the get-go. That's an extreme example. But in racing, the margins are so small that if there's a slight difference in the speed of the track over there and 10 yards this way, you know, that can very much impact on the result. So the analysis of the draw and the significance of the draw is a whole nother sector that gets an awful lot of attention, and people will really delve into to try to get an advantage.
If I'm running against you, I'm taking every advantage. I'm taking the car. That's what I'm doing. I'm taking the car. So we've got just a few minutes left. And while I find all that fascinating, probably too much so, if I am then tomorrow turning on the telly, turning on the radio, going on to Betfair, what's the kind of big tip? What should I really be looking for? And I don't mean the big tip, bet on this horse, but what's the one area I should really concentrate on and think, right, nail that first?
Oh, God, it's hard to name one because there is so much to it. And again, when one delves in, there's just so many different things. But I would say solid recent form is probably, and I say solid as in the horses have been running well of late. That's probably the best indicator to the likelihood of them running well again on the day you're looking at, you know, because horses, like humans, they can go into runs of form, you know, whether it's physical condition, whether it's mental condition, you know, when they're running well, it tends to mean they're in a good place physically and mentally, and they will continue to remain there for a while. It doesn't last forever. They will eventually tend to lose their form, but if they've gone and won their previous start, it seems like an obvious thing to say, but the likelihood of them running very well again is certainly attractive.
I don't know why it's got me thinking of this. Maybe because the way that I'm looking at you at the moment, you're sort of above me and I'm below. So let's think of you, the important one, the jockey. How much should I rely on the jockey? Should I go for a big name or someone that I know? Can they really turn things around on a maybe average horse?
Well, look, the greatest jockey in the world won't make a slow horse fast. You know, if one wanted to weigh it up in terms of percentage, I would dare say the horse is 97, 98% of the equation. But the jockey and the decisions he makes has the most certainly the potential to absolutely ruin a horse's chance. For me, a jockey's job is to, as best he can, allow the horse to show its full potential. And it's his job to know what way that horse wants to be ridden, what shows that horse the best effect, and essentially not interfering. You will occasionally see brilliant rides where the horse shouldn't really have won, but a decision a jockey made was the difference between losing and winning. But generally, jockeys will probably lose races that they should have won more so than win races they should have lost. So it's like anything, you know, and to very briefly swing off in a related direction, something you'll see with jockeys is we all know the big names, the Ryan Moores, the Frankie Dettori's, etc. They're well-established world stars. But what you'll see in day-to-day racing, you'll see a little number in brackets beside a jockey's name, perhaps a jockey you're not so familiar with, and that means they're claiming. And the system they have in place, right, is that when a young jockey or a jockey without much success is riding against a Ryan Moore or a Frankie Dettori, there's a system in place to compensate for their lack of experience and or success. So when a jockey starts off, they will receive £7 from a fully fledged jockey, such as Ryan Moore or Frankie Dettori. Every horse they ride will carry £7 less in a bid to equalize their chance against the Frankie or a Ryan Moore. And as they ride winners, that drops from £7 to £5 to £3. And it changes every so often. I think it's around 95 winners. After a jockey rides 95 winners, they become a fully fledged jockey and they have to take on the Ryan Moores, the Frankie Dettori's on level terms. So when you're looking at a race card, if you see a little number in brackets after that horse's name, after that rider's name, that's their claim. So it'll be 3, 5, or 7 in a bracket, and you know that your horse is carrying that much less to compensate for your jockey. But Caroline, the thing is, if you can identify a jockey that's particularly precocious or particularly good, despite not having ridden loads of winners, that claim is a massive, massive asset.
Do they swagger? What is it? Is there a twinkle? Is there a swagger?
Well, the way it tends to pan out is that when you get an apprentice jockey that is particularly good, they become very, very fashionable, and everyone will make it very, very clear that they represent good value for their claim. Kieran Fallon Jr., of course, has won last season, the son of multiple champion jockey Kieran Fallon, excellent young jockey, and he was claiming for much of last season. So again, if you can identify, and it can be one of the great things in betting and racing, if you can identify a jockey that is particularly good while they're a claimer before the wider world cops onto them, that can be a very advantageous betting strategy to just simply follow that jockey, because you know you're getting great value, because that this jockey is receiving weight in the shape of an allowance when really they're quite a bit better than that insinuates.
There's so many things for me to look out for, not least a new chair like yours with the leather and the studs behind it that shows that I'm all powerful. Kevin, before I let you go, is there anything else burning inside? Maybe you want to tell me why in America, do they go the other way around the course? Is that right?
They only race left-handed in America.
Why? Is it the driving thing?
You know, I don't know. That's the way they've always done it. It's a great thing about British and Irish racing. In America, they race around, the tracks are very, very similar. There's very little deviation in track design. They always go left-handed. They're generally just not quite an oval, but you know what I mean. They're very similar in shape and makeup. Whereas in Ireland and England, we have tracks of every shape, undulation, description. British and Irish racing is full of character, and our tracks are very, very unique. If you brought some American horsemen to Ireland and England and showed them some of the tracks we race on, where the Derby is held, Epsom. That's your homework now, Carolyn. When this lockdown is lifted, I want you to go to Epsom and walk the Derby track. And
with an American.
Walk it yourself, walk with as many people as you can bring, actually, because it's something that everyone should experience. It is the craziest racing venue you'll ever see in your life. Jump out of the stalls, you're going up a hill like that, you're going down a turn with a horrible camber, and then when you're running down the straight, you're on a camber, you're trying to run down this, and the ground's falling away from underneath you, and this is where the greatest horse race in the world is held. It's amazing, it really is. It's worth doing.
Hey, it was worth it just for the homework. I shall go and do that. My homeschool learning will be that when we're allowed out again. Kevin Blake, has been an absolute pleasure. If people want to follow you, why wouldn't they? Or hear more from you, how can they?
Sure, Twitter, I suppose, is a good place to start. I'm at Kevin Blake 2011, which isn't my date of birth, unfortunately. But we've only scratched the surface there, Karen. That has absolutely flown. As mentioned earlier, this is a bottomless ocean of of facts and information is horse racing. I could quite happily sit and have this conversation for as long as you could bear me, because it's a great game. And hopefully the showcase that racing will get in the coming weeks, when it's taking place when so many other sports aren't, will tempt and intrigue people enough to take a dip their toe into that ocean and hopefully to jump in and enjoy what is really, for me, the greatest sport in the world.
A swimming analogy, we've had school, we've had golf, we've had everything besides that. Kevin Blake, it's been an absolute pleasure. Remember to gamble responsibly. You can find out more via the Betfair website and follow at Betfair on social media. Now do that very cheesy goodbye, Kevin.
Goodbye.
Yeah, that was worth it too. Bye-bye.